The Beginnings of Nazi Foreign Policy. "It is no victory, for the enemies were lacking," observed Oswald Spengler in commenting on how easily Hitler had conquered and Nazified Germany in 1933. "This seizure of power," the author of The Decline of the West wrote early in the year, "it is with misgiving that I see it celebrated each day with so much noise. It would be better to save that for a day of real and definitive successes, that is, in the foreign field. There are no others." The philosopher-historian, who for a brief moment was an idol of the Nazis until a mutual disenchantment set in, was unduly impatient. Hitler had to conquer Germany before he could set out to conquer the world. But once his German opponents were liquidated, or had liquidated themselves, he lost no time in turning to what had always interested him the most, foreign affairs. Germany's position in the world in the spring of 1933 could hardly have been worse. The Third Reich was diplomatically isolated and militarily impotent. The whole world had been revolted by Nazi excesses, especially the persecution of the Jews. Germany's neighbors, in particular France and Poland, were hostile and suspicious. And as early as March 1933, following a Polish military demonstration in Danzig, Marshal Pilsudski suggested to the French the desirability of a joint preventive war against Germany. Even Mussolini, for all his outward pose of welcoming the advent of a second fascist power, had not in fact been enthusiastic about Hitler's coming to power. The Führer of a country potentially so much stronger than Italy might soon put the Duce in the shade. A rabidly pan-German Reich would have designs on Austria and the Balkans, where the Italian dictator had already staked out his claims. The hostility toward Nazi Germany of the Soviet Union, which had been Republican Germany's one friend in the years since 1921, was obvious. The Third Reich was indeed friendless in a hostile world, and it was disarmed, or relatively so, in comparison with its highly armed neighbors. The immediate strategy and tactics of Hitler's foreign policy, therefore, were dictated by the hard realities of Germany's weak and isolated position. But ironically, this situation also provided natural goals which corresponded to his own deepest desires and those of the vast majority of the German people. To get rid of the shackles of Versailles without provoking sanctions, to rearm without risking war. Only when he had achieved these dual short-term goals would he have the freedom and the military power to pursue the long-term diplomacy whose aims and methods he had set down so frankly and in such detail in Mein Kampf. The first thing to do, obviously, was to confound Germany's adversaries in Europe by preaching disarmament and peace, and to keep a sharp eye for a weakness in their collective armor. On May 17, 1933, before the Reichstag, Hitler delivered his peace speech, one of the greatest of his career, a masterpiece of deceptive propaganda that deeply moved the German people and unified them behind him, and which made a profound and favorable impression on the outside world. The day before, President Roosevelt had sent a ringing message to the chiefs of state of 44 nations, outlining the plans and hopes of the United States for disarmament and peace, and calling for the abolition of all offensive weapons, bombers, tanks, and mobile heavy artillery. Hitler was quick to take up the president's challenge and to make the most of it. "The proposal made by President Roosevelt, of which I learned last night, has earned the warmest thanks of the German government. It is prepared to agree to this method of overcoming the international crisis. The president's proposal is a ray of comfort for all who wish to cooperate in the maintenance of peace. Germany is entirely ready to renounce all offensive weapons if the armed nations, on their side, will destroy their offensive weapons. Germany would also be perfectly ready to disband her entire military establishment and destroy the small amount of arms remaining to her if the neighboring countries will do the same. Germany is prepared to agree to any solemn pact of non-aggression because she does not think of attacking but only of acquiring security." There was much else in the speech whose moderateness and profession of love for peace pleasantly surprised an uneasy world. Germany did not want war. War was unlimited madness. It would cause the collapse of the present social and political order. Nazi Germany had no wish to Germanize other peoples. The mentality of the last century, which led people to think that they would make Germans out of Poles and Frenchmen, is alien to us. Frenchmen, Poles, and others are our neighbors, and we know that no event that is historically conceivable can change this reality. There was one warning. Germany demanded equality of treatment with all other nations, especially in armaments. If this was not to be obtained, Germany would prefer to withdraw from both the Disarmament Conference and the League of Nations. The warning was forgotten amid the general rejoicing throughout the Western world at Hitler's unexpected reasonableness. The Times of London agreed that Hitler's claim for equality was irrefutable. The Daily Herald of London, official organ of the Labour Party, demanded that Hitler be taken at his word. The conservative weekly Spectator of London concluded that Hitler had grasped the hand of Roosevelt, and that this gesture provided new hope for a tormented world. In Washington, the president's secretary was quoted by the official German news bureau as saying, "The president was enthusiastic at Hitler's acceptance of his proposals." From the Nazi firebrand dictator had come not brutal threats, as so many had expected, but sweetness and light. The world was enchanted. And in the Reichstag, even the socialists' deputies, those who were not in jail or in exile, voted without dissent to make the assembly's approval of Hitler's foreign policy declaration unanimous. But Hitler's warning was not an empty one, and when it became clear early in October that the Allies would insist on an interval of 8 years to bring their armaments down to Germany's level, he abruptly announced on October 14th that, denied equality of rights by the other powers at Geneva, Germany was immediately withdrawing from the Disarmament Conference and from the League of Nations. At the same time, he took three other steps. He dissolved the Reichstag, announced that he would submit his decision to leave Geneva to a national plebiscite, and ordered General von Blomberg, the Minister of Defense, to issue secret directives to the armed forces to resist an armed attack should the League resort to sanctions. This precipitate action revealed the hollowness of the Hitler conciliatory speech in the spring. It was Hitler's first open gamble in foreign affairs. It meant that from now on, Nazi Germany intended to rearm itself in defiance of any disarmament agreement and of Versailles. This was a calculated risk, also the first of many, and Blomberg's secret directive to the Army and Navy, which came to light at Nuremberg, reveals not only that Hitler gambled with the possibility of sanctions, but that Germany's position would have been hopeless had they been applied. Some months previously, on May 11th, Lord Hailsham, the British Secretary of State for War, had publicly warned that any attempt of Germany to rearm would be a breach of the peace treaty and would be answered by sanctions in accordance with the treaty. In Germany, it was thought that sanctions would mean armed invasion. In the West against France and in the East against Poland and Czechoslovakia, the directive laid down definite defense lines which the German forces were ordered to hold as long as possible. It is obvious from Blomberg's orders that the German generals, at least, had no illusions that the defenses of the Reich could be held for any time at all. This, then, was the first of many crises over a period that would extend for 3 years, until after the Germans reoccupied the demilitarized left bank of the Rhine in 1936, when the Allies could have applied sanctions, not for Hitler's leaving the Disarmament Conference and the League, but for violations of the disarmament provisions of Versailles, which had been going on in Germany for at least 2 years, even before Hitler. That the Allies at this time could easily have overwhelmed Germany is as certain as it is that such an action would have brought the end of the Third Reich in the very year of its birth. But part of the genius of this one-time Austrian waif was that for a long time he knew the mettle of his foreign adversaries as expertly and as uncannily as he had sized up that of his opponents at home. In this crisis, as in those greater ones which were to follow in rapid succession up to 1939, the victorious Allied nations took no action, being too divided, too torpid, too blind to grasp the nature or the direction of what was building up beyond the Rhine. On this, Hitler's calculations were eminently sound, as they had been and were to be in regard to his own people. He knew well what the German people would say in the plebiscite, which he fixed, along with new elections of a single-party Nazi slate to the Reichstag, for November 12, 1933, the day after the anniversary of the 1918 armistice, a black day that still rankled in German memories. "See to it that this day," he told an election rally at Breslau on November 4th, "shall later be recorded in the history of our people as a day of salvation, that the record shall run, On an 11th of November, the German people formally lost its honor. 15 years later came a 12th of November, and then the German people restored its honor to itself. On the eve of the polling, November 11th, the venerable Hindenburg added his support in a broadcast to the nation. "Show tomorrow your firm national unity and your solidarity with the government. Support with me and the Reich Chancellor the principle of equal rights and of peace with honor, and show the world that we have recovered, and with the help of God will maintain German unity." The response of the German people, after 15 years of frustration and of resentment against the consequences of a lost war, was almost unanimous. Some 96% of the registered voters cast their ballots, and 95% of these approved Germany's withdrawal from Geneva. The vote for the single Nazi list for the Reichstag, which included Hugenberg and a half-dozen other non-Nazis, was 92%. Even at the Dachau concentration camp, 2,154 out of 2,242 inmates voted for the government which had incarcerated them. It is true that in many communities threats were made against those who failed to vote or who voted the wrong way, and in some cases there was fear that anyone who cast his vote against the regime might be detected and punished. Yet even with these reservations, the election, whose count at least was honest, was a staggering victory for Adolf Hitler. There was no doubt that in defying the outside world as he had done, he had the overwhelming support of the German people. 3 days after the plebiscite and election, Hitler sent for the new Polish ambassador, Józef Lipski. At the end of their talk, a joint communique was issued which amazed not only the German public but the outside world. The Polish and German governments agreed to deal with the questions touching both countries by means of direct negotiations and to renounce all application of force in their relations with each other for the consolidation of European peace. Even more than France, Poland was the hated and despised enemy in the minds of the Germans. To them, the most heinous crime of the Versailles peacemakers had been to separate East Prussia from the Reich by the Polish corridor, to detach Danzig, and to give to the Poles the province of Posen and part of Silesia, which, though predominantly Polish in population, had been German territory since the days of the partition of Poland. No German statesman during the Republic had been willing to regard the Polish acquisitions as permanent. Stresemann had refused even to consider an Eastern Locarno Pact with Poland to supplement the Locarno Agreement for the West. And General von Seeckt, father of the Reichswehr and arbiter of foreign policy during the first years of the Republic, had advised the government as early as 1922, "Poland's existence is intolerable, incompatible with the essential conditions of Germany's life. Poland," he insisted, "must go and will go. Its obliteration," he added, "must be one of the fundamental drives of German policy. With the disappearance of Poland will fall one of the strongest pillars of the Versailles peace, the hegemony of France." Before Poland could be obliterated, Hitler saw, it must be separated from its alliance with France. The course he now embarked on offered several immediate advantages besides the ultimate one. By renouncing the use of force against Poland, he could strengthen his propaganda for peace and allay the suspicions aroused in both Western and Eastern Europe by his hasty exit from Geneva. By inducing the Poles to conduct direct negotiations, he could bypass the League of Nations and then weaken its authority. And he could not only deal a blow to the League's conception of collective security, but undermine the French alliances in Eastern Europe, of which Poland was the bastion. The German people, with their traditional hatred of the Poles, might not understand, but to Hitler, one of the advantages of a dictatorship over democracy was that unpopular policies which promised significant results ultimately could be pursued temporarily without internal rumpus. On January 26, 1934, 4 days before Hitler was to meet the Reichstag on the first anniversary of his accession to power, announcement was made of the signing of a 10-year non-aggression pact between Germany and Poland. From that day on, Poland, which under the dictatorship of Marshal Pilsudski was itself just eliminating the last vestiges of parliamentary democracy, began gradually to detach itself from France, its protector since its rebirth in 1919, and to grow ever closer to Nazi Germany. It was a path that was to lead to its destruction long before the Treaty of Friendship and Non-Aggression, ran out. When Hitler addressed the Reichstag on January 30, 1934, he could look back on a year of achievement without parallel in German history. Within 12 months, he had overthrown the Weimar Republic, substituted his personal dictatorship for its democracy, destroyed all the political parties but his own, smashed the state governments and their parliaments, and unified and defederalized the Reich, wiped out the labor unions, stamped out democratic associations of any kind, driven the Jews out of public and professional life, abolished freedom of speech and of the press, stifled the independence of the courts, and coordinated under Nazi rule the political, economic, cultural, and social life of an ancient and cultivated people. For all these accomplishments and for his resolute action in foreign affairs, which took Germany out of the Concert of Nations at Geneva and proclaimed German insistence on being treated as an equal among the great powers, he was backed, as the autumn plebiscite and election had shown, by the overwhelming majority of the German people. Yet as the second year of his dictatorship got underway, clouds gathered on the Nazi horizon. The blood purge of June 30, 1934. The darkening of the sky was due to three unresolved problems, and they were interrelated. The continued clamor of radical party and SA leaders for the Second Revolution, the rivalry of the SA and the army, and the question of the succession to President Hindenburg, the sands of whose life at last began to run out with the coming of spring. Röhm, the chief of staff of the SA, now swollen to 2.5 million stormtroopers, had not been put off by Hitler's gesture of appointing him to the cabinet, nor by the Führer's friendly personal letter on New Year's Day. In February, he presented to the cabinet a lengthy memorandum proposing that the SA should be made the foundation of a new people's army, and that the armed forces, the SA and SS, and all veterans groups should be placed under a single Ministry of Defense, over which, the implication was clear, he should preside. No more revolting idea could be imagined by the officer corps, and its senior members not only unanimously rejected the proposal, but appealed to Hindenburg to support them. The whole tradition of the military caste would be destroyed if the roughneck Röhm and his brawling brown shirts should get control of the army. Moreover, the generals were shocked by the tales, now beginning to receive wide circulation, of the corruption and debauchery of the homosexual clique around the SA chief. As General von Brauchitsch would later testify, rearmament was too serious and difficult a business to permit the participation of peculators, drunkards, and homosexuals. For the moment, Hitler could not afford to offend the army, and he gave no support to Röhm's proposal. Indeed, on February 21st, he secretly told Anthony Eden, who had come to Berlin to discuss the disarmament impasse, that he was prepared to reduce the SA by 2/3 and to agree to a system of inspection to make sure that the remainder received neither military training nor arms. An offer which, when it leaked out, further inflamed the bitterness of Röhm and the SA. As the summer of 1934 approached, the relations between the SA chief of staff and the Army High Command continued to deteriorate. There were stormy scenes in the cabinet between Röhm and General von Blomberg, and in March the Minister of Defense protested to Hitler that the SA was secretly arming a large force of special staff guards with heavy machine guns, which was not only a threat against the army, but, General von Blomberg added, an act done so publicly that it threatened Germany's clandestine rearmament under the auspices of the Reichswehr. It is plain that at this juncture, Hitler, unlike the headstrong Röhm and his cronies, was thinking ahead to the day when the ailing Hindenburg would breathe his last. He knew that the aged president, as well as the army and other conservative forces in Germany, were in favor of a restoration of the Hohenzollern monarchy as soon as the field marshal had passed away. He himself had other plans, and when, early in April, the news was secretly but authoritatively conveyed to him and Blomberg from Neudeck that the president's days were numbered, he realized that a bold stroke must soon be made. To ensure its success, he would need the backing of the officer corps. To obtain that support, he was prepared to go to almost any length. The occasion for confidential parleys with the army soon presented itself. On April 11th, the Chancellor, accompanied by General von Blomberg and the commanders-in-chief of the army and the navy, General Freiherr von Fritsch and Admiral Raeder, set out on the cruiser Deutschland from Kiel for Königsberg to attend the spring maneuvers in East Prussia. The army and navy commanders were told of Hindenburg's worsening condition, and Hitler, backed by the compliant Blomberg, bluntly proposed that he himself, with the Reichswehr's blessing, be the president's successor. In return for the support of the military, Hitler offered to suppress Röhm's ambitions, drastically reduce the SA, and guarantee the army and navy that they would continue to be the sole bearers of arms in the Third Reich. It is believed that Hitler also held out to Fritsch and Raeder the prospect of an immense expansion of the army and navy, if they were prepared to go along with him. With the fawning Raeder, there was no question but that he would, but Fritsch, a tougher man, had first to consult his senior generals. This consultation took place at Bad Nauheim on May 16th, and after the Pact of the Deutschland had been explained to them, the highest officers of the German army unanimously endorsed Hitler as the successor to President Hindenburg. For the army, this political decision was to prove of historic significance. By voluntarily offering to put itself in the unrestrained hands of a megalomaniacal dictator, it was sealing its own fate. As for Hitler, the deal would make his dictatorship supreme. With the stubborn field marshal out of the way, with the prospect of the restoration of the Hohenzollerns snuffed out, with himself as head of state as well as of government, he could go his way alone and unhindered. The price he paid for this elevation to supreme power was paltry, the sacrifice of the SA. He did not need it now that he had all the authority. It was a raucous rabble that only embarrassed him. Hitler's contempt for the narrow minds of the generals must have risen sharply that spring. They could be had, he must have thought, for surprisingly little. It was a judgment that he held unaltered, except for one bad moment in June, to the end. His end and theirs. Yet as summer came, Hitler's troubles were far from over. An ominous tension began to grip Berlin. Cries for the second revolution multiplied. And not only Röhm and the stormtroop leaders, but Goebbels himself, in speeches and in the press which he controlled, gave vent to them. From the conservative right, from the Junkers and big industrialists around Papen and Hindenburg, came demands that a halt be called to the revolution, that the arbitrary arrests, the persecution of the Jews, the attacks against the churches, the arrogant behavior of the stormtroopers be curbed, and that the general terror organized by the Nazis come to an end. Within the Nazi party itself, there was a new and ruthless struggle for power. Röhm's two most powerful enemies, Göring and Himmler, were uniting against him. On April 1st, Himmler, chief of the black-coated SS, which was still an arm of the SA and under Röhm's command, was named by Göring to be chief of the Prussian Gestapo, and he immediately began to build up a secret police empire of his own. Göring, who had been made a General der Infanterie by Hindenburg the previous August, though he was Minister of Aviation, gladly shed his shabby brown SA uniform for the more showy one of his new office, and the change was symbolic. As a general and a member of a family from the military caste, he quickly sided with the army in its fight against Röhm and the SA. To protect himself in the jungle warfare which was now going on, Göring also recruited his own personal police force. The Landespolizeigruppe General Göring, several thousand men strong, which he concentrated in the former cadet school at Lichterfelde, where he had first entered the army and which was strategically located on the outskirts of Berlin. Rumors of plots and counterplots added to the tension in the capital. General von Schleicher, unable to bear a decent obscurity or to remember that he no longer enjoyed the confidence of Hindenburg, the generals, or the conservatives, and was therefore powerless, had begun to mix again in politics. He was in touch with Röhm and Gregor Strasser, and there were reports, some of which reached Hitler, that he was busy trying to make a deal whereby he would become vice-chancellor in place of his old enemy Papen, Röhm would become Minister of Defense, and the SA would be amalgamated with the army. Cabinet lists circulated by the dozen in Berlin. In some of them, Brüning was to be made foreign minister and Strasser Minister of Economics. These reports had little foundation, but they were grist to the mill of Göring and Himmler, who, desirous each for his own reasons to destroy Röhm and the SA, and at the same time to settle accounts with Schleicher and the disgruntled conservatives, embroidered them and brought them to Hitler, who at any time needed little prodding to have his suspicions aroused. What Goering and his Gestapo chief had in mind was not only to purge the SA, but to liquidate other opponents on the left and right, including some who had opposed Hitler in the past and were no longer politically active. At the end of May, Brüning and Schleicher were warned that they were marked for murder. The former slipped quietly out of the country in disguise. The latter went off on a vacation to Bavaria, but returned to Berlin toward the end of June. At the beginning of June, Hitler had a showdown with Röhm, which, according to his own account given to the Reichstag later, lasted for nearly 5 hours, and which dragged on until midnight. It was, Hitler said, his last attempt to come to an understanding with his closest friend in the movement. I informed him that I had the impression from countless rumors and numerous declarations of faithful old party members and SA leaders that conscienceless elements were preparing a national Bolshevist action that could bring nothing but untold misfortune to Germany. I implored him for the last time to voluntarily abandon this madness and instead lend his authority to prevent a development that, in any event, could only end in disaster. According to Hitler, Röhm left him with the assurance that he would do everything possible to put things right. Actually, Hitler later claimed, Röhm began preparations to eliminate me personally. This was almost certainly untrue. Though the whole story of the purge, like that of the Reichstag fire, will probably never be known, all the evidence that has come to light indicates that the SA chief never plotted to put Hitler out of the way. Unfortunately, the captured archives shed no more light on the purge than they do on the Reichstag fire. In both cases, it is likely that all the incriminating documents were destroyed on the orders of Goering. Whatever was the real nature of the long conversation between the two Nazi veterans, a day or two after it took place, Hitler bade the SA go on leave for the entire month of July, during which the stormtroopers were prohibited from wearing uniforms or engaging in parades or exercises. On June 7th, Röhm announced that he himself was going on sick leave, but at the same time he issued a defiant warning. If the enemies of SA hope that the SA will not be recalled, or will be recalled only in part after its leave, we may permit them to enjoy this brief hope. They will receive their answer at such time and in such form as appears necessary. The SA is and remains the destiny of Germany. Before he left Berlin, Röhm invited Hitler to confer with the SA leaders at the resort town of Wiesey, near Munich, on June 30th. Hitler readily agreed and indeed kept the appointment, though not in a manner which Röhm could possibly have imagined. Perhaps not in a way either that Hitler himself at this moment could foresee. For, as he later admitted to the Reichstag, he hesitated again and again before taking a final decision. I still cherished the secret hope that I might be able to spare the movement and my SA the shame of such a disagreement, and that it might be possible to remove the mischief without severe conflicts. It must be confessed, he added, that the last days of May continuously brought to light more and more disquieting facts. But did they? Later, Hitler claimed that Röhm and his conspirators had made preparations to seize Berlin and take him into custody. But if this were so, why did all the SA leaders depart from Berlin early in June, and, even more important, why did Hitler leave Germany at this moment and thus provide an opportunity for the SA chiefs to grab control of the state in his absence? For on June 14th, the Führer flew to Venice to hold the first of many conversations with his fellow fascist dictator, Mussolini. The meeting, incidentally, did not go off well for the German leader, who, in his soiled raincoat and battered soft hat, seemed ill at ease in the presence of the more experienced Duce, resplendent in his glittering, bemedaled black fascisti uniform, and inclined to be condescending to his visitor. Hitler returned to Germany in a state of considerable irritation and called a meeting of his party leaders in the little town of Gera in Thuringia for Sunday, June 17th, to report on his talks with Mussolini and to assess the worsening situation at home. As fate would have it, another meeting took place on that Sunday in the old university town of Marburg, which attracted much more attention in Germany and indeed in the world, and which helped bring the critical situation to a climax. The dilettante Papen, who had been rudely shoved to the sidelines by Hitler and Goering but who was still nominally vice-chancellor and still enjoyed the confidence of Hindenburg, summoned enough courage to speak out publicly against the excesses of the regime which he had done so much to foist on Germany. In May, he had seen the ailing president off to Neudeck, It was the last time he was to see his protector alive, and the grisly but enfeebled old field marshal had said to him, "Things are going badly, Poppin. See what you can do to put them right." Thus encouraged, Poppin had accepted an invitation to make an address at the University of Marburg on June 17th. The speech was largely written by one of his personal advisers, Edgar Jung, a brilliant Munich lawyer and writer and a Protestant, though certain ideas were furnished by one of the vice-chancellor's secretaries, Herbert von Bose, and by Erich Klausner, the leader of Catholic Action, a collaboration that soon cost all three of them their lives. It was a courageous utterance and, thanks to Jung, eloquent in style and dignified in tone. It called for an end of the revolution, for a termination of the Nazi terror, for the restoration of normal decencies, and the return of some measure of freedom, especially of freedom of the press. Addressing Dr. Goebbels, the propaganda minister, Poppin said, "Open, manly discussions would be of more service to the German people than, for instance, the present state of the German press. The government must be mindful of the old maxim, only weaklings suffer no criticism. Great men are not created by propaganda. If one desires close contact and unity with the people, one must not underestimate their understanding. One must not everlastingly keep them on leading strings. No organization, no propaganda, however excellent, can alone maintain confidence in the long run. It is not by incitement, and not by threats against the helpless part of the nation, but only by talking things over with people that confidence and devotion can be maintained. People treated as morons, however, have no confidence to give away. It is time to join together in fraternal friendship and respect for all our fellow countrymen, to avoid disturbing the labors of serious men and to silence fanatics." The speech, when it became known, was widely heralded in Germany, but it fell like a bombshell on the little group of Nazi leaders gathered at Gera, and Goebbels moved quickly to see that it became known as little as possible. He forbade the broadcast of a recording of the speech, scheduled for the same evening, as well as any reference to it in the press, and ordered the police to seize copies of the Frankfurter Zeitung, which were on the streets with a partial text. But not even the absolute powers of the propaganda minister were sufficient to keep the German people and the outside world from learning the contents of the defiant address. The wily Poppin had provided the foreign correspondents and diplomats in Berlin with advance texts, and several thousand copies were hastily run off on the presses of Poppin's newspaper, Germania, and secretly distributed. On learning of the Marburg speech, Hitler was stung to fury. In a speech the same afternoon at Gera, he denounced the pygmy who imagines he can stop with a few phrases the gigantic renewal of a people's life. Poppin was furious, too, at the suppression of his speech. He rushed to Hitler on June 20th and told him he could not tolerate such a ban by a junior minister, insisted that he had spoken as a trustee for the president, and then and there submitted his resignation, adding a warning that he would advise Hindenburg of this immediately. This was a threat that obviously worried Hitler, for he was aware of reports that the president was so displeased with the situation that he was considering declaring martial law and handing over power to the army. In order to size up the seriousness of this danger to the very continuance of the Nazi regime, he flew to Neudeck on the following day, June 21st, to see Hindenburg. His reception could only have increased his fears. He was met by General von Blomberg, and quickly saw that his defense minister's usual lackey-like attitude toward him had suddenly disappeared. Blomberg, instead, was now the stern Prussian general, and he brusquely informed Hitler that he was authorized by the field marshal to tell him that unless the present state of tension in Germany was brought quickly to an end, the president would declare martial law and turn over the control of the state to the army. When Hitler was permitted to see Hindenburg for a few minutes in the presence of Blomberg, the old president confirmed the ultimatum. This was a disastrous turn of affairs for the Nazi chancellor. Not only was his plan to succeed the president in jeopardy, if the army took over, that would be the end of him and of Nazi government. Flying back to Berlin the same day, he must have reflected that he had only one choice to make if he were to survive. He must honor his pact with the army, suppress the SA, and halt the continuance of the revolution for which the stormtroop leaders were pressing. The army, backed by the venerable president, it was obvious, would accept no less. And yet, in that last crucial week of June, Hitler hesitated, at least as to how drastic to be with the SA chiefs to whom he owed so much. But now, Goering and Himmler helped him to make up his mind. They had already drawn up the scores they wanted to settle, long lists of present and past enemies they wished to liquidate. All they had to do was convince the Führer of the enormity of the plot against him, and of the necessity for swift and ruthless action. According to the testimony at Nuremberg of Wilhelm Frick, the Minister of the Interior and one of Hitler's most faithful followers, it was Himmler who finally succeeded in convincing Hitler that Röhm wanted to start a putsch. The Führer, Frick added, ordered Himmler to suppress the putsch. Himmler, he explained, was instructed to put it down in Bavaria and Goering in Berlin. The army prodded Hitler too, and thereby incurred a responsibility for the barbarity which was soon to take place. On June 25th, General von Fritsch, the commander-in-chief, put the army in a state of alert, cancelling all leaves and confining the troops to barracks. On June 28th, Röhm was expelled from the German Officers' League, a plain warning that the SA chief of staff was in for trouble. And just to make sure that no one, Röhm above all, should have any illusions about where the army stood, Blomberg took the unprecedented step of publishing a signed article on June 29th in the Furkischer Beobachter, affirming that the army stands behind Adolf Hitler, who remains one of ours. The army, then, was pressing for the purge, but it did not want to soil its own hands. That must be done by Hitler, Goering, and Himmler, with their black-coated SS and Goering's special police. Hitler left Berlin on Thursday, June 28th, for Essen, to attend the wedding of a local Nazi Gauleiter, Josef Terboven. The trip and its purpose hardly suggest that he felt a grave crisis to be imminent. On the same day, Goering and Himmler ordered special detachments of the SS and the Goering police to hold themselves in readiness. With Hitler out of town, they evidently felt free to act on their own. The next day, the 29th, the Führer made a tour of labor service camps in Westphalia, returning in the afternoon to Godesberg on the Rhine, where he put up at a hotel on the riverbank run by an old war comrade, Dresen. That evening, Goebbels, who seems to have hesitated as to which camp to join, he had been secretly in touch with Röhm, arrived in Godesberg, his mind made up, and reported what Hitler later described as threatening intelligence from Berlin. Karl Ernst, a former hotel bellhop and ex-bouncer in a café frequented by homosexuals, whom Röhm had made leader of the Berlin SA, had alerted the stormtroopers. Ernst, a handsome but not a bright young man, believed then and for the remaining 24 hours or so of his life that he was faced by a putsch from the right, and he would die shouting proudly, "Heil Hitler!" Hitler later claimed that up to this moment, June 29th, he had decided merely to deprive the chief of staff, Röhm, of his office and for the time being keep him in custody and arrest a number of SA leaders whose crimes were unquestioned, and in an earnest appeal to the others, I would recall them to their duty. However, he told the Reichstag on July 13th, at 1 o'clock in the night I received from Berlin and Munich two urgent messages concerning alarm summonses. First, in Berlin, an alarm muster had been ordered for 4 p.m., and at 5 p.m. action was to begin with a surprise attack. The government buildings were to be occupied. Second, in Munich, the alarm summons had already been given to the SA. They had been ordered to assemble at 9 o'clock in the evening. That was mutiny. In these circumstances, I could make but one decision. Only a ruthless and bloody intervention might still perhaps stifle the spread of the revolt. At 2 o'clock in the morning, I flew to Munich. Hitler never revealed from whom the urgent messages came, but the implication is that they were sent by Goering and Himmler. What is certain is that they were highly exaggerated. In Berlin, SA leader Ernst thought of nothing more drastic than to drive to Bremen that Saturday with his bride to take a ship for a honeymoon at Madeira. And in the south, where the SA conspirators were concentrated? At the moment of 2 a.m. on June 30th, when Hitler, with Goebbels at his side, was taking off from Hangelar airfield near Bonn, Captain Röhm and his SA lieutenants were peacefully slumbering in their beds at the Hanselbauer Hotel at Wiese on the shores of the Tegernsee. Edmund Heines, the SA Obergruppenführer of Silesia, a convicted murderer, a notorious homosexual with a girlish face on the brawny body of a piano mover, was in bed with a young man. So far did the SA chiefs seem from staging a revolt that Röhm had left his staff guards in Munich. There appeared to be plenty of carousing among the SA leaders, but no plotting. Hitler and his small party, Otto Dietrich, his press chief, and Victor Lütze, the colorless but loyal SA leader of Hanover, had joined it, landed in Munich at 4 a.m. on Saturday, June 30th, and found that some action already had been taken. Major Walter Buch, head of Uschla, the party court, and Adolf Wagner, Bavarian minister of the interior, aided by such early cronies of Hitler as Emil Maurice, the ex-convict and rival for Geli Rabal's love, and Christian Weber, the horse dealer and former cabaret bouncer, had arrested the Munich SA leaders, including Obergruppenführer Schneidhuber, who was also chief of police in Munich. Hitler, who was now working himself up to a fine state of hysteria, found the prisoners in the Ministry of the Interior. Striding up to Schneidhuber, a former army colonel, he tore off his Nazi insignia and cursed him for his treason. Shortly after dawn, Hitler and his party sped out of Munich toward Wiesey in a long column of cars. They found Röhm and his friends still fast asleep in the Hanselbauer Hotel. The awakening was rude. Heines and his young male companion were dragged out of bed, taken outside the hotel, and summarily shot on the orders of Hitler. The Führer, according to Otto Dietrich's account, entered Röhm's room alone, gave him a dressing down, and ordered him to be brought back to Munich and lodged in Stadelheim prison, where the SA chief had served time after his participation with Hitler in the Beer Hall Putsch in 1923. After 14 stormy years, the two friends, who more than any others were responsible for the launching of the Third Reich, for its terror and its degradation, who, though they had often disagreed, had stood together in the moments of crisis and defeats and disappointments, had come to a parting of the ways, and the scar-faced, brawling battler for Hitler and Nazism had come to the end of his violent life. Hitler, in a final act of what he apparently thought was grace, gave orders that a pistol be left on the table of his old comrade. Röhm refused to make use of it. "If I am to be killed, let Adolf do it himself," he is reported to have said. Thereupon, two SA officers, according to the testimony of an eyewitness, a police lieutenant, given 23 years later in a post-war trial at Munich in May 1957, entered the cell and fired their revolvers at Röhm point-blank. "Röhm wanted to say something," said this witness, "but the SS officer motioned him to shut up. Then Röhm stood at attention. He was stripped to the waist, with his face full of contempt. And so he died, violently as he had lived, contemptuous of the friend he had helped propel to the heights no other German had ever reached, and almost certainly, like hundreds of others who were slaughtered that day, like Schneidhuber, who was reported to have cried, 'Gentlemen, I don't know what this is all about, but shoot straight,' without any clear idea of what was happening, or why, other than that it was an act of treachery which he, who had lived so long with treachery and committed it so often himself, had not expected from Adolf Hitler." The Munich trial in May 1957 was the first occasion on which actual eyewitnesses and participants in the June 30, 1934 purge talked in public. During the Third Reich, it would not have been possible. Sepp Dietrich, whom this author recalls personally as one of the most brutal men of the Third Reich, commanded Hitler's SS bodyguard in 1934 and directed the executions in Stadelheim prison. Later, a colonel general in the Waffen-SS during the war, he was sentenced to 25 years in prison for complicity in the murder of American prisoners of war during the Battle of the Bulge in 1944. Released after 10 years, he was brought to Munich in 1957 and sentenced on May 14th to 18 months in prison for his part in the June 30th, 1934 executions. His sentence and that of Michael Lippert, who was convicted as being one of the two SS officers who actually killed Röhm, was the first punishment given to the Nazi executioners who took part in the purge. In Berlin, in the meantime, Göring and Himmler had been busy. Some 150 SA leaders were rounded up and stood against a wall of the cadet school at Lichterfelde and shot by firing squads of Himmler's SS and Göring's special police. Among them was Karl Ernst, whose honeymoon trip was interrupted by SS gunmen as his car neared Bremen. His bride and his chauffeur were wounded. He himself was knocked unconscious and flown back to Berlin for his execution. The SA men were not the only ones to fall on that bloody summer weekend. On the morning of June 30th, a squad of SS men in mufti rang the doorbell at General von Schleicher's villa on the outskirts of Berlin. When the general opened the door, he was shot dead in his tracks, and when his wife, whom he had married but 18 months before, he had been a bachelor until then, stepped forward, she too was slain on the spot. General Kurt von Bredow, a close friend of Schleicher, met a similar fate the same evening. Gregor Strasser was seized at his home in Berlin at noon on Saturday and dispatched a few hours later in his cell in the Prinz Albrechtstrasse Gestapo jail on the personal orders of Göring. Papen was luckier. He escaped with his life. But his office was ransacked by an SS squad, his principal secretary, Boza, shot down at his desk, his confidential collaborator, Edgar Jung, who had been arrested a few days earlier by the Gestapo, murdered in prison, another collaborator, Eric Klausener, leader of Catholic Action, slain in his office in the Ministry of Communications, and the rest of his staff, including his private secretary, Baroness Stotzingen, carted off to concentration camp. When Papen went to protest to Göring, the latter, who at that moment had no time for idle talk, more or less, he later recalled, threw him out, placing him under house arrest at his villa, which was surrounded by heavily armed SS men, and where his telephone was cut and he was forbidden to have any contact with the outside world. An added humiliation which the Vice-Chancellor of Germany swallowed remarkably well. For within less than a month he defiled himself by accepting from the Nazi murderers of his friends a new assignment as German minister to Vienna, where the Nazis had just slain Chancellor Dollfuss. How many were slain in the purge was never definitely established. In his Reichstag speech of July 13th, Hitler announced that 61 persons were shot, including 19 higher SA leaders, that 13 more died resisting arrest, and that 3 committed suicide, a total of 77. The White Book of the Purge, published by émigrés in Paris, stated that 401 had been slain, but it identified only 116 of them. At the Munich trial in 1957, the figure of more than 1,000 was given. Many were killed out of pure vengeance for having opposed Hitler in the past. Others were murdered apparently because they knew too much, and at least one because of mistaken identity. The body of Gustav von Kahr, whose suppression of the beer hall putsch in 1923 we have already recounted, and who had long since retired from politics, was found in a swamp near Dachau, hacked to death, apparently by pickaxes. Hitler had neither forgotten nor forgiven him. The body of Father Bernhard Stempfle of the Hieronymite Order, who, it will be remembered from earlier pages, helped edit Mein Kampf and later talked too much, perhaps, about his knowledge of why Hitler's love, Gaily Raubal, committed suicide, was found in the forest of Herlaching near Munich, his neck broken and 3 shots in the heart. Haydn says the murder gang that killed him was led by Emil Maurice, the ex-convict who had also made love to Gaily Raubal. Others who knew too much included 3 SA men who are believed to have been accomplices of Ernst in setting the Reichstag on fire. They were dispatched with Ernst. One other murder deserves mention. At 7:20 on the evening of June 30th, Dr. Willy Schmidt, S-C-H-M-I-D, the eminent music critic of the Münchener Neueste Nachrichten, a leading Munich daily newspaper, was playing the cello in his study while his wife prepared supper, and their 3 children, aged 9, 8, and 2, played in the living room of their apartment in the Schachstrasse in Munich. The doorbell rang, 4 SS men appeared, and without explanation took Dr. Schmidt away. 4 days later, his body was returned in a coffin with orders from the Gestapo not to open it in any circumstances. Dr. Willy Schmidt, who had never participated in politics, had been mistaken by the SS thugs for Willy Schmidt, S-C-H-M-I-D-T, a local SA leader who in the meantime had been arrested by another SS detachment and shot. Kate Eva Herlin, former wife of Willy Schmidt, the music critic, told the story of her husband's murder in an affidavit sworn on July 7, 1945, at Binghamton, New York. She became an American citizen in 1944. To hush up the atrocity, Rudolf Hess himself visited the widow, apologized for the mistake, and secured for her a pension from the German government. The affidavit is given in Nuremberg document L-135 NCA, Roman 7, pages 883-890. Was there a plot against Hitler at all? There is only his word for it, contained in the official communiques and in his Reichstag speech of July 13th. He never presented a shred of evidence. Röhm had made no secret of his ambition to see the SA become the nucleus of the new army and to head it himself. He had certainly been in touch with Schleicher about the scheme, which they had first discussed when the general was chancellor. Probably, as Hitler stated, Gregor Strasser was brought in. But such talks certainly did not constitute treason. Hitler himself was in contact with Strasser, and early in June, according to Otto Strasser, offered him the post of Minister of Economics. At first, Hitler accused Röhm and Schleicher of having sought the backing of a foreign power, obviously France, and charged that General von Bredow was the intermediary in foreign policy. This was part of the indictment of them as traitors. And though Hitler repeated the charges in his Reichstag speech and spoke sarcastically of a foreign diplomat, who could have been no other than François Poncet, the French ambassador, explaining that the meeting with Schleicher and Röhm was of an entirely harmless character, he was unable to substantiate his accusations. It was crime enough, he said lamely, for any responsible German in the Third Reich even to see foreign diplomats without his knowledge. When three traitors in Germany arrange a meeting with a foreign statesman and give orders that no word of this meeting shall reach me, then I shall have such men shot dead, even when it should prove true that at such a consultation which was thus kept secret from me, they talked of nothing more than the weather, old coins, and like topics. When François Poncet protested vigorously against the insinuation that he had participated in the Röhm plot, the German Foreign Office officially informed the French government that the accusations were wholly without foundation, and that the Reich government hoped the ambassador would remain in his post. Indeed, as this writer can testify, François Poncet continued to remain on better personal terms with Hitler than any other envoy from a democratic state. In the first communiques, especially in a blood-curdling eyewitness account given the public by Otto Dietrich, the Führer's press chief, and even in Hitler's Reichstag speech, much was made of the depraved morals of Röhm and the other SA leaders who were shot. Dietrich asserted that the scene of the arrest of Heines, who was caught in bed at Wiesey with a young man, defied description, and Hitler, in addressing the surviving stormtroop leaders in Munich at noon on June 30th, just after the first executions, declared that for their corrupt morals alone these men deserved to die. And yet Hitler had known all along, from the earliest days of the party, that a large number of his closest and most important followers were sexual perverts and convicted murderers. It was common talk, for instance, that Heines used to send SA men scouring all over Germany to find him suitable male lovers. These things Hitler had not only tolerated but defended. More than once he had warned his party comrades against being too squeamish about a man's personal morals if he were a fanatical fighter for the movement. Now, on June 30, 1934, he professed to be shocked by the moral degeneration of some of his oldest lieutenants. Most of the killing was over by Sunday afternoon, July 1st, when Hitler, who had flown back to Berlin from Munich the night before, was hosted a tea party in the gardens of the Chancellery. On Monday, President Hindenburg thanked Hitler for his determined action and gallant personal intervention, which have nipped treason in the bud and rescued the German people from great danger. He also congratulated Göring for his energetic and successful action in suppressing high treason. On Tuesday, General von Blomberg expressed to the Chancellor the congratulations of the cabinet, which proceeded to legalize the slaughter as a necessary measure for the defense of the state. Blomberg also issued an order of the day to the army expressing the high command's satisfaction with the turn of events and promising to establish cordial relations with the new SA. It was natural, no doubt, that the army should be pleased with the elimination of its rival, the SA, but what about the sense of honor, let alone of decency, of an officer corps which not only condoned but openly praised a government for carrying out a massacre without precedent in German history, during which two of its leading officers, Generals von Schleicher and von Bredow, having been branded as traitors, were cold-bloodedly murdered. Only the voices of the 85-year-old Field Marshal von Mackensen and of General von Hammerstein, the former commander-in-chief of the army, were raised in protest against the murder of their two fellow officers and the charges of treason which had been the excuse for it. The two senior officers continued their efforts to clear the names of Schleicher and Bredow, and succeeded in getting Hitler at a secret meeting of party and military leaders in Berlin on January 3, 1935, to admit that the killing of the two generals had been in error, and to announce that their names would be restored to the honor rolls of their regiments. This rehabilitation was never published in Germany, but the officer corps accepted it as such. See Wheeler Bennett, The Nemesis of Power, page 337. This behavior of the corps was a black stain on the honor of the army. It was also a mark of its unbelievable short-sightedness. In making common cause with the lawlessness, indeed the gangsterism of Hitler on June 30, 1934, the generals were putting themselves in a position in which they could never oppose future acts of Nazi terrorism, not only at home but even when they were aimed across the frontiers, even when they were committed against their own members. For the army was backing Hitler's claim that he had become the law, or, as he put it in his Reichstag speech of July 13th, "If anyone reproaches me and asks why I did not resort to the regular courts of justice, then all I can say is this. In this hour I was responsible for the fate of the German people, and thereby I became the supreme judge, Oberster Gerichtsherr, of the German people." And Hitler added, for good measure, "Everyone must know for all future time that if he raises his hand to strike the state, then certain death is his lot." This was a warning that was to catch up with the generals in 10 years almost to a day, when at last the more desperate of them dared to raise their hand to strike down their supreme judge. Moreover, the officer corps only deluded itself in thinking that on June 30th it got rid forever of the threat of the Nazi movement against its traditional prerogatives and power. For in the place of the SA came the SS. On July 26th, the SS, as a reward for carrying out the executions, was made independent of the SA, with Himmler, as its Reichsfuhrer, responsible only to Hitler. Soon this much better disciplined and loyal force would become much more powerful than the SA had ever been, and as a rival to the army would succeed where Röhm's ragged brown shirts had failed. For the moment, however, the generals were smugly confident. As Hitler reiterated in his Reichstag address on July 13th, the army was to remain the sole bearer of arms. At the high command's bidding, the Chancellor had got rid of the SA, which had dared to dispute that dictum. The time now came when the army had to carry out its part of the Pact of the Deutschland. The Death of Hindenburg. All through the summer, the seemingly indestructible Hindenburg had been sinking, and on August 2nd, at 9 in the morning, he died in his 87th year. At noon, 3 hours later, it was announced that according to a law enacted by the Cabinet on the preceding day, the offices of Chancellor and President had been combined, and that Adolf Hitler had taken over the powers of the head of state and commander-in-chief of the armed forces. The title of president was abolished. Hitler would be known as Führer and Reich Chancellor. His dictatorship had become complete. To leave no loopholes, Hitler exacted from all officers and men of the armed forces an oath of allegiance. Not to Germany, not to the Constitution, which he had violated by not calling for the election of Hindenburg's successor, but to himself. It read, "I swear by God the sacred oath that I will render unconditional obedience to Adolf Hitler, the Führer of the German Reich and people, supreme commander of the armed forces, and will be ready as a brave soldier to risk my life at any time for this oath." From August 1934 on, the generals, who up to that time could have overthrown the Nazi regime with ease had they so desired, thus tied themselves to the person of Adolf Hitler, recognizing him as the highest legitimate authority in the land, and binding themselves to him by an oath of fealty which they felt honor-bound to obey in all circumstances, no matter how degrading to them and the fatherland. It was an oath which was to trouble the conscience of quite a few high officers when their acknowledged leader set off on a path which they felt could only lead to the nation's destruction, and which they opposed. It was also a pledge which enabled an even greater number of officers to excuse themselves from any personal responsibility for the unspeakable crimes which they carried out on the orders of a supreme commander whose true nature they had seen for themselves in the butchery of June 30th. One of the appalling aberrations of the German officer corps, from this point on, rose out of this conflict of honor, a word which, as this author can testify by personal experience, was often on their lips and of which they had such a curious concept. Later, and often, by honoring their oath, they dishonored themselves as human beings and trod in the mud the moral code of their corps. When Hindenburg died, Dr. Goebbels, the Minister of Propaganda, officially announced that no last will and testament of the Field Marshal had been found, and that it must be presumed there was none. But on August 15th, 4 days before the plebiscite in which the German people were asked to approve Hitler's taking over the president's office, Hindenburg's political testament turned up, delivered to Hitler by none other than Papen. Its words of praise for Hitler provided strong ammunition to Goebbels in the final days of the plebiscite campaign, and it was reinforced on the eve of the voting by a broadcast of Colonel Oskar von Hindenburg. "My father had himself seen in Adolf Hitler his own direct successor as head of the German state, and I am acting according to my father's intention when I call on all German men and women to vote for the handing over of my father's office to the Führer and Reich Chancellor." It is interesting and perhaps revealing that Hitler now promoted Oskar from colonel to major general. Almost certainly this was not true, for Hindenburg, on the best evidence available, had recommended as his last wish a restoration of the monarchy after his death. This part of the testament Adolf Hitler suppressed. Some, if not all, of the mystery which cloaked the truth about the aged president's testament was cleared up after the war by Papen's interrogation at Nuremberg and later in his memoirs. And while Papen is not an unimpeachable witness and may not have told all he knew, his testimony cannot be ignored. He himself wrote the initial draft of Hindenburg's last will, and according to him, at the field marshal's request. "My draft," he says in his memoirs, "recommended that after his death a constitutional monarchy should be adopted, and I made a point of the inadvisability of combining the offices of president and chancellor. In order to avoid giving any offense to Hitler, there were also certain approving references to some of the positive accomplishments of the Nazi regime." Papen delivered his draft to Hindenburg in April 1934, he says. "A few days later he asked me to call on him again and told me that he had decided not to approve the document in the form I had suggested. He felt that the nation as a whole should make up its mind as to the form of state it desired. He therefore intended to regard the account of his service as a testament, and his recommendations concerning the return of the monarchy would be expressed as his last wish in a private letter to Hitler. This meant, of course, that the whole point of my original suggestion had been lost, as the recommendation concerning the monarchy was no longer addressed to the nation, a fact of which Hitler later took full advantage." No German was as well placed as Papen to observe how Hitler took the advantage. "When I returned to Berlin after Hindenburg's funeral at Tannenberg, Hitler rang me up. He asked me if a political testament by Hindenburg existed, and if I knew where it was. I said that I would ask Oskar von Hindenburg. 'I should be obliged,' said Hitler, 'if you would ensure that this document comes into my possession as soon as possible.' I therefore told Kageneck, my private secretary, to go to Neudeck and ask Hindenburg's son if the testament still existed, and whether I could have it to pass it on to Hitler. As I had not seen Hindenburg after he left Berlin at the end of May, I had no idea whether he had destroyed the testament or not." Oskar, who had not been able to find the important document immediately after his father's death, suddenly found it. That this could not have been a very difficult feat was attested to by Count von der Schulenburg, Hindenburg's adjutant, in his testimony at Papen's denazification trial. He revealed that the president on May 11th signed two documents, his testament and his last wishes. The first was addressed to the German people, and the second to the Reich Chancellor. When Hindenburg left Berlin on his last journey to Neudeck, Schulenburg took the papers with him. Papen says he did not know this at the time. But in due course, his secretary returned from Neudeck bringing two sealed envelopes turned over to him by Oscar von Hindenburg. On August 15th, Papen delivered them to Hitler at Berchtesgaden. Hitler read both documents with great care and discussed the contents with us. It was obvious that Hindenburg's recommendations in the document expressing his last wishes were contrary to Hitler's intentions. He therefore took advantage of the fact that the envelope bore the address Reich Chancellor Adolf Hitler. "These recommendations of the late president," he said, "are given to me personally. Later I shall decide if and when I shall permit their publication." In vain I begged him to publish both documents. The only one handed to his press chief for publication was Hindenburg's account of his service, in which he included praise of Hitler. What happened to the second document, recommending that not Hitler but a Hohenzollern become head of state, Papen does not say and perhaps does not know. Since it has never turned up among the hundreds of tons of captured secret Nazi documents, it is likely that Hitler lost no time in destroying it. Perhaps it would have made little difference if Hitler had been courageous and honest enough to publish it. Even before Hindenburg's death, he had made the cabinet promulgate a law giving him the president's powers. This was on August 1st, the day before the field marshal died. That the law was illegal also made little difference in a Germany where the former Austrian corporal had now become the law itself. That it was illegal was obvious. On December 17, 1932, during the Schleicher government, the Reichstag had passed by the necessary two-thirds majority an amendment to the Constitution providing that the President of the High Court of Justice, instead of the Chancellor, should act as President until a new election could be held. And while the Enabling Act, which was the legal basis of Hitler's dictatorship, gave the Chancellor the right to make laws which deviated from the Constitution, it specifically forbade him to tamper with the institution of the presidency. But what mattered the law now? It mattered not to Papen, who cheerfully went off to serve Hitler as minister in Vienna and smooth over the mess caused by the murder of Chancellor Dollfuss by the Nazis. It mattered not to the generals, who went eagerly to work to build up Hitler's army. It mattered not to the industrialists, who turned enthusiastically to the profitable business of rearmament. Conservatives of the old school, decent Germans like Baron von Neurath in the Foreign Office and Dr. Schacht in the Reichsbank, did not resign. No one resigned. In fact, Dr. Schacht took on the added duties of Minister of Economics on August 2nd, the day Hitler seized the powers of the expiring president. And the German people? On August 19th, some 95% of those who had registered went to the polls, and 90%, more than 38 million of them, voted approval of Hitler's usurpation of complete power. Only 4.25 million Germans had the courage or the desire to vote no. No wonder that Hitler was in a confident mood when the Nazi Party Congress assembled in Nuremberg on September 4th. I watched him on the morning of the next day stride like a conquering emperor down the center aisle of the great flag-bedecked Luitpold Hall, while the band blared forth the Badenweiler March, and 30,000 hands were raised in the Nazi salute. A few moments later, he sat proudly in the center of the vast stage, with folded arms and shining eyes, as Gauleiter Adolf Wagner of Bavaria read the Führer's proclamation. The German form of life is definitely determined for the next 1,000 years. The age of nerves of the 19th century has found its close with us. There will be no other revolution in Germany for the next 1,000 years. Being mortal, he would not live 1,000 years, but as long as he lived, he would rule this great people as the most powerful and ruthless autocrat they had ever had. The venerable Hindenburg was no longer there to dispute his authority. The army was in his hands, bound to obedience by an oath no German soldier would lightly break. Indeed, all Germany and all the Germans were in his blood-stained hands now that the last recalcitrants had been done away with or had disappeared for good. "It is wonderful," he exulted at Nuremberg to the foreign correspondents at the end of the exhausting week of parades, speeches, pagan pageantry, and the most frenzied adulation for a public figure this writer had ever seen. Adolf Hitler had come a long way from the gutters of Vienna. He was only 45, and this was just the beginning. even one returning to Germany for the first time since the death of the Republic, could see that whatever his crimes against humanity, Hitler had unleashed a dynamic force of incalculable proportions, which had long been pent up in the German people. To what purpose, he had already made clear in the pages of Mein Kampf and in 100 speeches which had gone unnoticed or unheeded or been ridiculed by so many, by almost everyone, within and especially without the Third Reich.